And if anybody wants to just make themselves comfortable, feel free to leave the doors open. So if people want to just lounge on the couches out there and listen from that side, I think we have a screen over there. So that's, we had a shortage of chairs in the first panel. We want everybody to be comfy. Well, I am extremely excited to welcome you all back and to listen to this blockbuster panel. I'm so excited to bring these people here. I believe that, Donald, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think any of these people have actually testified before the commission, or if so, it's been a really, really long time.
I have.
You have? Okay. Well, it's been a really, really long time. This is not the usual suspects for us, which I think is so important for us to hear different perspectives, and what this panel is going to do is to try and bring in some perspectives from different areas of the law. We have on this panel John Coates, who teaches corporate governance and finance at Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School, and before coming to Harvard, he was a partner at the Wall Street law firm Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. So any of the lawyers in the room, we've all heard of Wachtell, so he has seen it from both sides, the academic and the practical side. Robert Jackson is professor of law and co-director of the Ira M. Milstein Center for Global Markets and Corporate Ownership at Columbia Law School. How incredibly relevant to what we're talking about today, where his research emphasizes empirical study of executive compensation and corporate governance matters. Before joining the faculty in 2010, Professor Jackson served as an advisor to senior officials at the Department of the Treasury and in the Office of the Special Master for TARP Executive Compensation. Mace Rosenstein is a partner at Covington & Burling and chair of the firm's Media, Internet, and Telecommunications practice area. His practice is focused on, among other things, what he calls arcane foreign investment limitations under the Communications Act and implementing FCC rules and policy. And my dear old friend Donald Tobin is dean of the University of Maryland Carey School of Law and a former faculty member and associate dean at the renowned Ohio State School of Law, which is so well known for its election law professors and teaching and scholarship. He's also a former Justice Department attorney and former Capitol Hill aide and has spent his career working at the intersection of election law and tax law. And the purpose of this panel was to try and bring in these experts to help guide us and bring some perspectives from other areas of the law that are not just focused on the FECA, the Federal Election Campaign Act. So we're going to do this in alphabetical order. So Professor Coates, start us off.
Okay, thank you. And thank you very much for the invitation to be in a place I don't usually go, right? So my background, as the introduction alluded, is from the corporate governance and financial market side, and I was blissfully ignorant of and happy to ignore everything that everybody else in this room spent their careers focusing on until Citizens United. And actually, in fairness, Citizens United did wake me up to something that I think the corporate law community has neglected too, which is the way that corporations have, long before Citizens United, but not going back that far to the 70s, started using the Constitution quite aggressively and opportunistically to deregulate when they lose the lobbying battles that they are very good at fighting. So they get two rounds of regulatory reform, one in the actual regulatory process and another in court, where they're increasingly using the First Amendment to take on greater and greater pieces of the regulatory world, an area that I've written about. But today I'm going to focus principally on a couple of narrow topics, drawing on my teaching and research in the corporate law area, and just to make some basic points about disclosure or its absence of ownership, including foreign ownership, and the fact that in many, many domains, nevertheless, there are longstanding statutes, regulations, legal traditions for treating foreign companies and foreign influenced and controlled companies quite differently than we treat domestic, and there's nothing particularly surprising or pernicious about that. It's not an embrace of nativism. It's not an embrace of Trump's approach to trade. It's a standard part of the way that every country thinks about regulating business activity in their country. So, as you all probably know, there's no disclosure obligation on companies as such in the U.S. to disclose their political activity. There have been efforts ongoing to try to get the SEC to do something for public companies. But Chevron could spend $1 million into astroturfing currently, and no one would know unless they bragged about it, not even its current owners, right? So that's standard baseline. But there's probably a bigger gap in the disclosure laws that you may not be fully aware of, which is there's no general obligation for a company operating in the U.S. to tell anybody who its owners are. There are more than 5 million active business corporations active enough to file returns with the IRS, and of those, less than 1% are public companies. And even of the public companies essentially have obligations only to disclose the ownership interests of the people currently executive officers or directors of the company, or if they own more than 5%. But again, just want to stress, most companies, including very, very large companies, are not public and not even subject to that disclosure regime. So in sum, if the public wants to know who owns a given company that shows up in any forum as a donor, for example, in the FEC regulatory process, there's no way to find out actually who owns that company under normal disclosure obligations. There are some reporting requirements to specific pieces of the government, I'll come back to that in a second, such as the IRS, but they're generally not available to the public, and they're very carefully circumscribed in how that data can be used. So is this an issue? Is there any reason to think that foreign control of U.S. companies is common? Well, actually, yes. That IRS data I was just alluding to discloses in the most recent update I could find about $12 trillion of assets owned by U.S. companies that were controlled by foreign owners, 51% or more, something like 100,000 such companies with a non-trivial amount of revenue and assets operating in the U.S. One you all know, actually. So you know that Budweiser can you've seen turn into something called America. It's actually owned by a Belgium company in the lovely city of Belgium, as Donald Trump has referred to it recently. Okay. What about less than full control? IRS collects data on full control, controlled companies. There's a separate data regime that the Federal Reserve Bank in New York and the U.S. Treasury run where they survey banks and brokers and issuers, large issuers, to try to figure out how much portfolio investment, that is, non-controlling investment, there is into U.S. corporate stock. And the best data from that is that an astonishing increase, actually, over the past 30 years. Back to 1982, about 5% of all U.S. corporate stock was held or controlled by foreigners. It's now up to 25. So let that sink in for a second. So $1 in $4 in value terms in U.S. corporations is controlled directly or indirectly by a foreign owner. Now, what kind of foreign owner? Well, we don't know. It's part of the disclosure gap. They could be individuals, they could be companies, they could be governments. And of course, in many countries like China, governments and businesses are essentially identical. And so a little hard to tease out, even if you know the country from which the investment is coming. The largest single country source in that data, which they report, is the Cayman Islands. Which means basically it could be anybody, anywhere in the world, since the Cayman Islands are not exactly a location for major independent economic activity. It's really a location for corporate fictional entities to shelter their ownership. Okay. What about elections? Is there any indication that corporations, in fact, are moving into the elections? You probably already heard about this to some extent on the first panel, but just to pick out a couple things to reiterate if you haven't heard them. Earlier in this presidential cycle, $2.5 million was given to Rubio's single candidate super PAC by a Panamanian company. There you go. We don't know the owners of that company. I know one of them, Hank Greenberg, because I was involved in a litigation involving Star and AIG in which that company figured, but the actual total current composition of the ownership is unknown because it's a private company and there's no obligation to disclose in any forum the owners of that company. There's a company called Children of Israel, LLC, you may have read about in the Washington Post, organized in the U.S. by a Silicon Valley realtor named Lisa Gao, who has no prior history of making political donations herself. Her job, which she markets herself as, is a realtor in the Silicon Valley area, helping PRC Chinese nationals find houses in Silicon Valley. They've given money, that LLC, which she's the president of, has given money to a number of single candidate super PACs. $1 in $8 flowing to the super PACs are now come from corporations, and that, of course, doesn't count dark money. Where the principal organized groups are predominantly business corporation members, chamber, business roundtable, etc. Larry Tribe in yesterday's Boston Globe pointed out that Uber and Lyft are now playing a massive and completely unheralded, previously unheralded, role in local elections, fighting off local requirements that they get their drivers to have background checks. And finally, and I think actually the thing that's the most troubling from an overall policy perspective are the ghost companies, where, as you probably know, companies spring up within a week, make a $250,000 donation to a single candidate super PAC, and no one has any idea who these companies are, who they're owned by, anything else. They're likely owned by U.S. citizens, just by my guess, on average, but we don't know, and we certainly don't know what's going to be coming down the pike. That path has been laid. Now, just to make my final point, are there precedents for thinking about differentially regulating foreign companies? I mean, obviously, free trade. Parity of treatment when it comes to trade and business is a standard part of the ideology, at least traditionally, within both parties and within most of the population if they think about it over time, long and hard enough about it. You know, sometimes we flirt with protectionism, but not in a serious way. However, coinciding with that long tradition of free trade, we have very specific foreign restrictions throughout a number of different industries, just as every country in the world does. So to take the most obvious, defense, you simply can't do business with the Defense Department unless you go through a very specific regulatory approval process, and they won't grant it to many countries because of national security concerns. Infrastructure is another big category, shipping, aircraft, telecom. All of those industries have very strict limits on foreign ownership. Some ban it completely, and some it's regulated through an approval process. And maybe not so obvious, financial services. Now, the crisis hopefully has taught the lesson. The financial markets are a type of crucial public infrastructure, and we regulate foreign ownership in this area. There's a recent deal that fell apart involving an insurance company based in Iowa called Fidelity Life. Angban, a Chinese company, was going to buy them. They announced a deal. The New York Life Insurance Commissioner asked, as is typical, who owns you, the buyer, and that company refused to disclose their ownership, and the deal died over that. It's a multi-billion-dollar deal. That company actually owns the Waldorf Astoria, in case any of you are sleeping there anytime soon. You're sleeping in a hotel owned by a company that refuses to disclose its ownership to the New York State Life Insurance Company as part of a routine acquisition. Now, one reason probably for the sensitivity of ownership disclosure in that case is that the current chairman is married to a granddaughter of the former chairman of the party in China. And the New York Times has done a little sleuthing around what little disclosure there is in China and has found that two of the shareholders are state-owned enterprises, i.e. they're part of the government of China, and 37 other companies are companies owned by other companies, which in turn are owned by other companies, which are in turn owned by other companies. In other words, you can't trace the ownership in any serious way, probably because it all ultimately traces back to, let's say, economically and politically advantaged descendants of the founders of the party in China, which could be politically embarrassing within China. So that's an example of where we already have, for good reason, an existing skepticism about foreign ownership. There are many. What more fundamental feature of our government is the protection of the republic? Foreign interest and domestic interests are going to predictably diverge if you're appointing a president, an independent committee chairman, etc., to a political system that has oversight of the industries where we ban foreign ownership. It's a little odd then to allow foreign influence to occur at the top of that chain and not farther down that chain. That is to say, if the Defense Department can ban somebody from participating in a contract, why would you let people with influence over the contract higher up the chain be influenced through the electoral system by the very same foreign companies? And I will stop there.
Well, that was great. Thank you so much. Bob?
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. For those of you who haven't had a chance to meet yet, I'm Robert Jackson. I teach corporate law and corporate finance at Columbia. Thank you to the commissioner for having us today and to our staff for making this possible. I'm like Professor Coates, also a corporate lawyer. I have the sense security downstairs might have known that. They looked at me skeptically. Like, you guys aren't allowed here. What are you doing here? I'm going to be brief because I have only a few points to make, and also because the other people on the panel are smarter than me. Professor Coates was my corporate law professor, so I really don't have anything interesting to say.
He did well.
So let me offer through. I'm going to focus on a slightly different topic than Professor Coates did. One of the topics of the panel that's been set out for us is for us to tell you what is the state of other areas of the law, and what can it tell you about election law and what it should look like. So I'm going to focus on that. And in particular, I'm going to focus on the law that governs political spending by large public companies in the United States. So I'm going to focus on that subject. I'm going to tell you what the state of the law is, how it's changing, and then at last, I'm going to make a plea to you. I'm going to lobby you for some help. So first, let me say the question is, what is the state of the law governing large public companies, the Coca-Colas, the IBMs, and whether and how they can take shareholders' money and spend it on politics? That was one of the questions. What's the state of the law? And I'm here to tell you, we don't have any. The reason is that corporate and securities law is typically not concerned with these subjects. In fact, until the Citizens United decision and the things that preceded it, corporate and securities law focused on rather different matters, questions of the shareholders' interests, do the managers have those in mind? But we didn't imagine that corporations would have this very powerful constitutional right to spend the shareholders' money on politics until the Supreme Court told us. In a series of decisions that, of course, culminated with Citizens United in 2010. When they did, a few of us started thinking about, well, now that corporations have this power, what should be the rules of the game for how they use it? Who decides? The management, the directors, the shareholders, whose money it is? We didn't know because we really hadn't given the topic much thought. And so a few of us have set out, myself included, with Professor Coates' colleague, Lucian Bebchuk, to try and establish, get a sense for what the rules of the game ought to be if a large public company wants to take shareholder money and use it for political purposes. The first thing I want to say about this is that in the area of corporate law, when I say we don't have any law about this, I'm not joking. We actually don't have rules that govern this. What we have is the standard default rule of American corporate law, which is known, for those of you who remember it from law school, as the business judgment rule. This is a rule that says the people who run the corporation are experts. We should let them make decisions as experts and leave them alone when they do. And it's a good rule. I'm a fan of this rule. It applies in almost all situations where corporations make decisions, except this one, where the manager's interests, those who control the corporation, are different from those of those who own it, the shareholders. A good example is executive compensation. In that area, often the managers want to pay themselves more and the shareholders would rather they take less, and so they have a conflict of interest. And we have law that deals with that. We allow the shareholders to get information about it. We have mandatory disclosure of this stuff. And also, recently, because of the Dodd-Frank Act, we give shareholders a vote on what they think of the executive's pay. We don't have any of that in corporate law when it comes to political spending. We treat corporate spending on politics as a business judgment. That is, we treat it just like the decision to buy a factory or hire or fire people. We treat it as a judgment where the managers are using shareholder money and presumably in the shareholders' interest. And if I convince you of anything today, it should be that that's the wrong rule for this kind of thing. That instead, in this area, the manager's interests are very different from those of the shareholders, or at least they could be, because shareholders don't choose what corporations they own based on the corporation's politics. They choose it on the basis of the business or their interest in diversification. And because the directors, the manager's interests might conflict with those of shareholders, we need special rules in this area. And so, to be honest with you, my message for you today is not so much what we can tell you about corporate law, but instead the ways that election law can help us build a better corporate law for these questions. Because as I say, we don't have any law in that area. For that reason, several law professors 5 years ago petitioned the Securities and Exchange Commission to develop a rule requiring corporations to disclose to their investors when corporate money is used for politics. You see, the idea here would be if the managers use the money in a way that shareholders don't like, well, shareholders will get information about that. And if they do, then shareholders can take action. They can sell the company's stock. They can vote out the directors who are doing stuff they don't like. But without that information, these markets can't work. It's a little bit like executive pay. We said the SEC should require disclosure of this. And it was a group of 10 corporate law professors, 9 famous ones, and me, who asked the Securities and Exchange Commission to require disclosure of this. And I'm happy to say that this petition has gained some support. More than 1.2 million people have written to the SEC and asked them to do this. That makes it the most commented petition in the history of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And for a brief moment in time, it appeared the SEC might take action on the petition under the last chairman. But then we got a new chairman who was called to a hearing at the House of Representatives and asked by every majority member of that panel not to do it. And shortly thereafter, the petition came off the SEC's agenda, and that's where it stayed during this chairman's term. My hope is that the next election will give us a new president and a new chairman of the SEC, and when it does, it'll be important for this new chairman to take seriously the need for a rule in this area. But in the meantime, I want to tell you what we have in corporate law for disclosure of political spending. Because it's not quite right to say we don't have anything at all, we just have no law. Instead, we have voluntary agreements between company shareholders and their managers, where more than 100 of the largest US public companies agree voluntarily to disclose that information at shareholders' request. Requests from shareholders that companies do this, these are through shareholder proposals that can be made to US public companies, are among the most common topics, subjects of proposals, shareholder proposals in the United States. They have overwhelmingly led to voluntary agreements by the largest public companies to disclose this stuff. And see, you might say to me, well, look, Jackson, that means we don't need an SEC rule in this area, because you see, companies are doing it voluntarily. So let's just wait until they all do. So that's wrong. Let me say why. First, in general, when we need information about something, when US investors need information about something a corporation is doing, we don't make them ask on a company-by-company basis, because there are like 11,000 public companies and that takes a lot of time. Also, shareholders are diversified. They have very few incentives to take that kind of action. And so there's it's unlikely that they're going to do it. But putting that to one side, the bigger problem is the companies that will agree to disclose voluntarily are the ones least likely to be spending corporate money in a way shareholders don't like. See, that's why they're willing to volunteer the information, or at least that would be a concern. And so the voluntary efforts in this area, they exist. And if you go to public company websites, you'll see information on how they spend on politics, but you'll see it in this selected way, just the tip of the iceberg for the actual amount of corporate political spending that's happening in this country. And that brings me to my last point, my plea to you, my pitch to election law experts here and otherwise. You see, one of the reasons that the SEC has refused to develop the rule I just described is that they claim they lack the expertise. They say, well, you know, elections are complicated. It's not our thing. We have lots of good securities lawyers, but you know, this election stuff, we don't really know anything about it, so we can't do it. So I've pointed out to them that this building exists. And that there are some extraordinary election lawyers who know about things like, should there be a de minimis limit of political spending that doesn't have to be disclosed or not? When should it be disclosed? What form should it be disclosed in? Whether there should be exemptions for certain kinds of disclosures. You see, they claim to be clueless about this, but my sense is you have ideas. And I want to urge you to share them with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the reason I say this is that as long as these two groups of lawyers don't talk to each other, they'll be able to claim that the reason they haven't done this is because they don't know how. And based on what I've heard this morning and what I'm sure you'll hear for the rest of the day, that's not a good enough answer. In fact, we do have the capacity, both inside and outside the government, to write a rule that would give investors transparency as to what's happening in corporate political spending. And I hope you'll help them do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hayes.
Well, I'm the piker on this panel, obviously, because, you know, I'm just a lowly communications attorney. This isn't my space, and I'm also not as smart as any of these guys, but I'll fake it, okay? So just humor me.
Don't believe any of them when they say
that. I practice in one of the areas that Professor Coates mentioned does have an existing regime to regulate foreign investment and ownership, and that's in the telecom space. So I guess that's a good thing. You know, you guys can sort of write on a blank slate here. I have a century-old statutory regime that I have to struggle with in trying to adapt to modern exigencies. And I thought it might make sense because the FCC does have a very complex statutory and regulatory and policy regime to walk you through some of the highlights of it that they might inform some of the thinking that you guys are doing and some of the discussion that is going on today. So this is where it becomes sort of the dry lecture portion of the program, but I think it'll be interesting. As I mentioned, the fundamental challenge that I think the FCC faces and that practitioners in this area face and that the regulated parties face is that our law governing foreign investment, which is embodied in the Communications Act, was enacted in 1934, and it hasn't changed since. And what's even more interesting is that its underpinnings, really its progeny, its provenance can be traced back to the Radio Act of 1912, over 100 years ago, when the whole world looked different, much less our communications infrastructure and our communications policy infrastructure. Congress, in fact, first became concerned about foreign ownership of radio communications in 1912. You ready for this? There was no commercial communications infrastructure industry. They were concerned that Germany or its proxies might gain control of privately held ship-to-shore radio stations along the East Coast in the run-up to the First World War, and that they might use those facilities in order to send merchant ships off course and into the shoals. That's where our problem began, if you will, because ever since that time, the Congress and the Commission have struggled with how, to what extent, to regulate foreign investment in this sector. So let me walk through with you a little bit about that statutory underpinning. And I think what you'll see is, and this may not be what this room wants to hear, because the progression, the evolution of the FCC in this area has been from strict prohibition to a much more permissive environment. To the extent that now, and I'm fast-forwarding, we'll get there, now, for all intents and purposes, it is possible to have 100% foreign ownership of a U.S. communications facility with certain exceptions that we can talk about. So, since 1934, when the Communications Act was promulgated, wireless communications licensees, think broadcasters, and for our purposes today, think cell phone operators, right? Anything that allows you to communicate by over spectrum without putting a signal through a wire, has been subject to Section 310 of the Act. 310 does about three different things. First, it prohibits any foreign government or its representative or any alien or any representative of an alien, and an alien has the common sense definition here, or any foreign organized corporation from holding an FCC license, period, full stop. If you're a foreigner, if you're a foreign corporation, much less a foreign government, you may not apply to the FCC to hold a radio license. That's the first thing. The second thing 310 does is prohibits foreign individuals and foreign governments and foreign organized corporations from owning or voting more than 20% of the equity or voting interests in an FCC licensee. So you can't be a licensee outright, but you can hold up to a 20% interest in a licensee, whether it's a C Corp, whether it's a partnership, whether it's an LLC. Interestingly, and we'll sort of touch on this in a little bit too, the FCC, notwithstanding that that is an outright and categorical limit, the FCC has determined within the last 3 or 4 years that it has discretion to forbear from enforcing that limit when it believes that the public interest warrants doing so. So in effect, the FCC has determined that it has discretion, and that hasn't been challenged, to allow relaxation of that 20% statutory cap. And then we get to Section 310b4, which is the provision that has most bedeviled our industry and the FCC, and that I want to focus on today, and that has to do with the limitation of indirect investment in FCC licensees. That is, an investment in a U.S. organized entity that itself, in turn, either directly or indirectly controls that licensee entity that we were talking about a second ago. Here's what it does, and it is I can't project it here. If you're interested, you should go back and look at it, because it is one of the least artfully drafted statutory provisions I've ever come across. Admittedly, my practice area is narrow, but the Communications Act is a really big document. Section 310(b)(4) limits indirect foreign ownership to 25%. Okay, so it's a bump up from the direct ownership cap. If the commission finds that the public interest would be served by prohibiting it, right? So a common sense reading of the statute, and the statute by its terms appears to say it's okay to own as much as you want unless the FCC tells you that you can't. However, historically, the FCC interpreted it as a cap, as a categorical cap that could only be, if you will, waived, not the technically correct term, upon application to the FCC. So it's an interesting tension. The FCC historically just read the statute wrong, in my view, and said, no, you can't own more than 25% unless you come to us, even though what the statute says is you can own as much as you want unless the FCC tells you you can't. That has been one of the challenges that we've dealt with the interpretation and application of this statute through the years. I should note, and I don't want to get too far down into the weeds, but it also may be relevant to some of the things that you're going to be thinking about. The 25% limitation is calculated separately for voting and equity interests. So the FCC will run two separate calculations and must be satisfied that neither the voting prong nor the economic prong exceeds 25% in order for you to be able to certify or for it to find that you're in compliance with the limitation. And that equity ownership generally is calculated on an outstanding rather than a fully diluted basis, and it generally disregards debt, including convertible debt. It disregards contingent future interests, such as warrants or options, until they're exercised. And over time, this will not surprise you, vehicles such as debt, including convertible debt, and options and warrants have become preferred mechanisms in the industry in order to screen ownership from the foreign ownership calculation. Right. In other words, I can issue warrants to my foreign investors, and until they're exercised, they're not relevant to either to my disclosure to the FCC or to the FCC's calculation of the foreign ownership quotient. But of course, because there's an exception to every rule, the FCC also determined, goaded by Rupert Murdoch in 1995, that it has discretion to pierce a nominal capital structure where it has reason to believe that that structure doesn't align, at least reasonably, that it's not on the curve with the actual locus of economic ownership. Let's digress there briefly. My disclaimer and disclosure here is that this was my case. Recall that Murdoch became a U.S. citizen in 1985-86 because he wanted to buy a bunch of TV stations here. And remember, under 310, he couldn't because he wasn't a U.S. citizen. And he arranged, shall we say, an expedited path to citizenship. That was not my part of the case. My part of the case came, 10 years later when a whistleblower went to the FCC and said, hang on, his ownership disclosures at the FCC indicated that he has 76% of the voting and equity interests, right? Because he had to keep the foreign interest below 25%. Whereas the News Corporation, an Australian company, owns the other 24%, but records indicate that he only paid $760,000 for his 76% voting control interest, and the company is worth however many multiple billions of dollars. That resulted in a protracted and very difficult FCC proceeding. And that case resulted in the FCC's determination that, in fact, it has the power to pierce a capital structure, because what it said was, hang on, Murdoch only put down $760,000, and yet he says he controls 76% of this company. 99%+ of the economic value and risk is flowing out to the shareholders of the News Corporation Limited, an Australian company. Here's another behind-the-scenes look at the FCC. It's a very result-driven agency, all right?
they had a huge problem when they made the finding that the company was out of compliance with the statute, because theoretically it could have led to the revocation of those licenses and would have been the end of the line for Fox, which at that time was only a few years old and had provided a fourth national broadcast network, which had been a huge policy objective and initiative of the FCC for generations. We first argued from the statute, and we lost, and I won't go into to that argument. We then tried to recapitalize the company using debt, and we said, okay, fine, you know, you don't count debt, we'll just, you know, we'll just recapitalize and all that, and the company will issue debt to News Corporation. And the FCC, looking in part to the service and tax law, said, no, you can't have a 99.9% to 0.1 debt equity ratio. And so then the FCC reverted to Plan C, which was purple cow and a waiver, right? They couldn't take the risk that Murdoch would take his chips and go home and shut down the fourth network. So they said, you know what? This is a unique situation. It's never going to recur. The public interest value of that fourth network is really, really important. So we will allow this structure, we will bless this structure and essentially forbear from enforcing that 25% cap under the statute, even though everybody acknowledges that it's not in compliance. So life went on. That's not an unusual approach for the FCC to take when they have two conflicting sort of policy objectives. And as it happens, as a footnote, you probably know that News Corp has been redomiciled in Delaware. The public float has done what a public float will do over time. Over time, the attributable foreign ownership in the public float has settled down at around 25% or less. There have been a couple of bumps up. The FCC has mechanisms to deal with that. Let's go back to history briefly. As I mentioned, the Radio Act of 1912 completely forbade any foreign ownership, period, nothing. 15 years later, Congress in the 1927 Radio Act decided that they would begin to permit some foreign ownership, so they set limits on direct foreign ownership, that 20% limit that we've talked about, but that's all that they did. And the legislative history emphasized national security concerns for those restrictions, and that's something, again, that we've been talking about a little bit today. And in particular, they wanted to prevent foreign influence over domestic communications in time of war. By 1927, of course, there was over-the-air entertainment radio, right? You could get your crystal set and you could listen to the radio, and so the concern had evolved not just from those ship-to-shore communications that had a very sort of practical implication and consequence, but the concern had broadened to a more generalized concern that a hostile foreign power could propagandize and influence the hearts and minds of American radio listeners. But the 27 Congress left something out. They forgot about indirect foreign ownership, and of course, communications lawyers being what they are and the industry being what it is, they determined that this loophole could allow them to evade foreign ownership restriction altogether simply by organizing a U.S. holding company, right? In 1934, that loophole is closed, and that's when we landed on the regime that we have now with the limitation to 25% on indirect foreign ownership. 60 or so years passed. The commission, from time to time and on a very ad hoc basis, would permit foreign ownership in excess of 25%, although always in the common carrier context, the telephone context, never in the broadcast context. And I want to spend just a few minutes on that too, because again, I think it's relevant to what we're talking about here. And then came the WTO in the mid-90s, and in particular, the Basic Telecommunications Agreement, pursuant to which I think about 65 or 70 countries around the world undertook to open their telecommunications markets. We, of course, joined the WTO and ratified it, but we took a reservation for broadcasting. We said we will only open our wireless radio markets, that is cell phones, but we're not going to open the broadcast sector. And in short order, after the adoption of the WTO, you saw the floodgates opening a little bit. You saw more access to foreign capital. And I think in 2001, you saw Deutsche Telekom's acquisition of what was then called VoiceStream Wireless, which you would now know as T-Mobile, which is owned 100% by the government of Germany. Senator Hollings vociferously opposed that transaction, but the FCC concluded that under the WTO, it really had no choice and could not identify any public interest harms to allowing a friendly foreign state to own critical United States telecommunications infrastructure. And in the years since then, that was sort of the signal event in this transition. But since that time, the FCC has approved, I think, between 150 to 200 instances of foreign ownership of a wireless common carrier licensee in excess of 25%. They have only allowed such ownership twice in the broadcast context. Once was Murdoch, and more recently, the Pandora case, in which Pandora, you know, the music service, was seeking to acquire a terrestrial radio station. As a public company, had difficulty calculating its foreign ownership, went to the FCC and asked for permission to go to 49%, which the commission approved, subject to certain reporting and other requirements. A couple of minutes, and I'm finishing soon, I promise, a couple of minutes on this common carrier broadcast dichotomy, again, because I think it might inform some of the stuff that we're talking about today. As I mentioned, you know, historically the concern in general about foreign ownership was that foreign powers could acquire and disrupt our sort of private communications, our ship-to-shore communications. Later, as I mentioned, with the emergence of commercial broadcasting, there was a concern that foreign powers could manipulate U.S. public opinion over the radio or over television. In contrast to what the FCC has characterized as its traditionally heightened concern for foreign influence over control of licensees which exercise editorial discretion over the content of their transmissions, read broadcasters, they've justified their willingness to consider foreign investment in common carrier licensees on the ground that they're just merely passive conduits for information provided by others. Let's pause for a second. I'd ask you to think about whether that rationale can continue to be squared with the realities of telecommunications technology and the media marketplace in the 21st century. And in fact, I think what you'll see is that policymakers, not just telecommunications policymakers, are becoming increasingly concerned about foreign influence, not over broadcast content, because as we all know, nobody watches broadcast television anymore anyway, but the possibility that foreign agents or hostile foreign governments could engage in cyber warfare using our communications networks. And I dare say that's probably trending in the right direction, because communications infrastructure, think about the information that, you know, they may be passive conduits, and after the open internet decision from the court a couple of weeks ago, they may be sort of locked into being passive conduits, but our communications networks control the delivery and processing of vast amounts of highly sensitive information, not just for the government, but for financial institutions and other markets. And I think, you know, one could argue that the Commission, if it were to re-examine these issues, might want to be shifting its focus away from broadcasting. You know, how much influence can you exercise by owning a radio station in Fargo to our wired and unwired communications networks, given the vast quantities of data that they distribute and given their vulnerabilities from a national security perspective. In partial recognition, I think, of that reality, starting in around 2000, 2001, the Commission started to refer transactions involving foreign investment to Team Telecom. You know what I mean when I talk about Team? Isn't that a great name, by the way? Like Team USA, Team Telecom, right? Team Telecom is an interagency task force comprising DOJ, FBI, Homeland Security, and Defense, which reviews every single FCC transaction involving a certain quantum of foreign investment. And they review it from a national security perspective. And in fact, the process has evolved to the point now where the FCC will either unilaterally refer a transaction out to Team Telecom, or more often will hear from Team Telecom as soon as the transaction is filed, and Team Telecom will instruct the FCC to put down its pen until such time as the Team Telecom National Security Review has been completed. Sometimes it's uneventful. Sometimes it results in what's called a national security agreement, in which the transaction parties are obligated to enter into essentially a contract with the government regulating certain aspects of their network operations. And now it appears from the Pandora case and a couple of other pending proceedings that that same lens will be brought to bear on broadcast transactions as well, as the Commission works to rationalize its approach to foreign ownership now across sectors and is taking baby steps to harmonize its treatment of broadcasters and its treatment of common carriers. And finally, on methodology, because I know that is another issue, and I will shut up now. You know, once you get me started on this, I it's very hard to get me to stop. But historically, the Commission, I should say, is a very open agency. It's very transparent. There are fairly extensive disclosure obligations on applicants for new radio stations, on applicants to sell or acquire radio stations or FCC licenses. There are periodic ownership reporting requirements of all FCC licensees. Just in the ordinary course, they have to make certain disclosures about certain of their owners. And they also have to certify compliance with the foreign ownership provisions of the Communications Act at certain junctures in the licensing process and in their license renewal process. Historically, the FCC has left it to licensees to determine how they're going to figure out what their foreign ownership is. Obviously, in closely held corporations, they know. The Commission has allowed you to rely on known shareholders, registered shareholders, management holdings. They've allowed you to conduct surveys, and they will accept any survey that produces a statistically significant result. But more recently, they've started to legislate the types of methodology that are acceptable, in particular in recognition of the challenge that big global public companies face in knowing who owns them. And the Commission, I think, has conceded that, in fact, it's very difficult, and you guys will keep me honest, for corporations to know who owns them. And I think if you were to go carefully and review SEC filings and give it some thought and maybe do a little regression analysis, you might find that companies that nominally are in compliance with the 25% cap or believe that they are or can represent that they are, aren't, and that their foreign ownership may be well in excess of 25% from time to time or in any given moment in time, but it may be impossible for them to know that. So among those steps that the Commission is considering in a pending proceeding that was launched last October would be to accept shareholder street addresses as proxy for citizenship, absent circumstances under which the filer has knowledge or should know that a domestic street address is being used by a foreigner. They're taking a very close look, and I was in last week talking to them about whether to use the SEG 100 process. Do you know what that is? It's a I can't understand it, but it is, I guess, an algorithm or software that's deployed by the Depository Trust Company that allows corporations to tag shares and to segregate them based on certain characteristics, in this case, on whether the corporation has reason to believe that they're foreign-owned, or I guess whether the holder itself acknowledges that it's foreign-owned or not. The FCC is asking a lot of questions about that. And in an interesting liberalization, they are reconsidering their historic position that an unknown response to a survey or an unknown shareholder must be deemed to be foreign. And among the proposals they're considering would be some sort of proportional test that, you know, that unreported shares or unknown shares would be treated in proportion to known shares with respect to foreign versus domestic ownership. That proceeding is pending. the commission is working very hard to rationalize its process, and the industry is, I think, very engaged in trying to get to something that works both for the industry and for the agency. I'll be quiet.
Well, thank you very much. I want to note that our non-professor gave an incredibly wonky professorial presentation. So we thank you for that. That was really illuminating. Donald.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Weintraub, and thank you for hosting today.
I should say Dean Tobin. I'm sorry.
That's all right. For hosting today's event, it was actually 12 years ago that I testified before the commission to talk about the regulation of 527 political organizations. So amazingly, things have not changed much since that time. I've lost a lot of hair, but beyond that, not much has changed. The Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission dramatically changed our campaign finance landscape by really creating an entirely new type of donor. Although much has been written about the decision and about the consequences of corporate spending on independent election advocacy, very little has looked at the ramifications of how to fit corporate election activity within our current regulatory framework, or about what new regulations are necessary in order to ensure compliance by corporations with existing election laws. The Supreme Court has found that corporations have a right to engage in independent election advocacy, but it has not clearly enunciated what the principles are that underlie that right. So as regulators think through how to ensure corporate compliance with existing election laws, they must consider how strongly corporations differ from individual citizens and how those different characteristics raise tremendous regulatory questions. So today what I'd like to discuss is, as we look at some of these unanswered questions, how do we look at tax law and maybe a little bit of corporate law to see what rules and what lessons we can learn? So let's start with the assumption that Citizens United will remain good law. I then see two areas where the uniqueness of the corporate form creates significant regulatory challenges, and those involve both donations by foreign nationals and by government contractors and disclosure. In the tax context, policymakers have struggled for years with the corporate form and how some corporations can be used by people to manipulate and obfuscate tax laws. Tax shelters, tax evasion, tax cheats often use complex corporate arrangements, including the use of holding companies or other sub-corporations as a means of hiding income. Recent public outcry surrounding the Panama Papers highlights the length that individuals will go to avoid U.S. tax law. What tax law teaches us is that the use of the corporate form to manipulate compliance with the law is not a theoretical problem, but it's a real one. For example, considering the existing rule that foreign nationals are prohibited from engaging in electioneering communication. In simple terms, a foreign individual could create a Wyoming corporation. The Wyoming corporation could be the sole owner of a Delaware corporation that in turn could own a Nevada corporation. The Nevada corporation could then engage in independent expenditures on behalf of a candidate. For those of you who don't practice corporate law, I hope I've picked the four most difficult corporate states as far as disclosure to be able to break the corporate structure. So under existing law, it would be incredibly difficult for any government entity, including the FEC, to have any idea that the funds in question came from a foreign individual. Similar problems exist with regard to the disclosure provisions. In Citizens United, the court upheld disclosure as justified based on a government interest in providing the electorate with information and acknowledged that there was evidence in the record in McConnell that independent groups were running election-related advertisements while hiding behind dubious and misleading names. Complex entity relationships hide donors from both the public and from regulators. If we had individuals donating in the name of another person, that would be criminal. But our existing regulatory regime seems perfectly comfortable allowing this to be done through the corporate form. So in thinking through the regulatory responses to these problems, I suggest we actually have to think of three different types of corporate entities. We have our publicly held corporate entities, we have our privately held corporate entities, and then we have tax-exempt organizations, which have often been put under this corporate rubric. That doesn't even include LLCs, who have generally been regulated as partnerships. So why do I suggest that difference? Well, these entities have very different operations, they have very different ways of acting that I think have significant different ramifications in the election law context. Publicly traded corporations are traded on stock exchange. They usually have very diverse groups of shareholders. They're highly regulated under securities law. And in this case, an owner of a publicly held corporation is not generally contributing to the capital of the corporation. They're generally buying their shares from someone else. So when we think about corporate money in that context being spent on elections, we're actually thinking of shareholder profits that are being used in that way. So then when we look at that, we have to think, well, what are the underlying rationales for allowing corporations to participate in political campaigns? Are we concerned about who owns the corporation? Are we concerned about who controls the corporation? Are we concerned about who's funding the election activities? We have to understand, in a sense, the evil we're trying to address so we can think about the ways to solve that problem. So I think there's several ways to look at this in the publicly held context. And the first is really when we're looking at sort of beneficial ownership. What is the way in which somebody has enough ownership of the corporation that they're really involved? And in a different context, the SEC has used a 5% threshold for determining that amount. And I don't know, you know, the 5% is not magic. It's actually in a totally different context. But what it does tell us is it wouldn't be overly burdensome to ask a publicly traded corporation to know who its owners were in the 5 to 10% range, right? It's clearly very difficult for them to know it in the 0.01% range. It's clearly hard for them to know who owns any share. But if we're really talking about somebody who owns a significant share of a publicly traded corporation, it's really not that hard, not that burdensome to require the shareholder to disclose that information. So that's one way we've looked at that before. The second way corporate law and tax law often looks at this is effective control. Not just if you have a 50% shares of the corporation, but do you have enough ownership interest that you really control the activity of the corporation? So we could look at effective control in making our determinations. And then an out-of-the-box kind of way that we've looked at this is our CFIUS regulations, which is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which looks at foreign ownership of defense-related activities where there's a national security interest. And there, it looks at a functional definition of control. So there is not a bright-line test. And in lots of other areas of election law and tax law, we argue about bright-line tests versus not bright-line tests. But what CFIUS is really looking at is what ability do the shareholders have to control the activities of the corporation, and looks at a whole set of different activities there. So we do have models to look at to say, when is enough enough? When is the participation in a publicly held corporation, which has diffuse ownership, enough that we really want to think about regulating it? The second is privately held, and that gets, to me at least, a lot scarier, and we heard that a little bit in the earlier panel. But unlike publicly held corporations, in the privately held context, capital contributions to the privately held corporation may, in fact, be providing funds to the corporation that the corporation could use for election advocacy. So in other contexts, I've written about the concern that taxable entities will become the new major loophole for campaign advocacy, and that what you'll do is give to a corporation as a contribution to capital that's not taxed, and then that capital contribution will be spent by the privately held corporation on election advocacy. If a foreign owner contributed capital to a privately held corporation, and that privately held corporation then spent that money on election advocacy, we would have no idea that was happening. And our existing regulatory regime has no way for identifying that. So here, we need to have some method that requires privately held corporations who engage, right? It's not every privately held corporation. Most do not actually engage in election advocacy. Who engage in election advocacy to disclose how the corporation received its funds, where its funds come from, and give us some type of disclosure about at least the owners that have effective control of the corporation. But I would even say we could look at the 5% threshold for privately held corporations. The last area I want to talk about, and to me it's actually the most scary, is tax-exempt organizations. They don't really, the Supreme Court has kind of treated them like corporations, but they're totally different than corporations. They don't really fit within a lot of the concerns we have in corporations, but what they do is shield incredibly well donors. And at the moment, at least, you could give a foreign contribution to, let's say, the favorite social welfare organization, and as long as that foreign contribution wasn't designated for the purpose of electioneering communication or for the purpose of a particular ad, there's no disclosure requirement on that contribution, right? And that money can be mixed with the money of lots of other people in a very fungible way. So we've had a crisis, I think, on disclosure in the tax-exempt context for some time. But I think what we're highlighting now is this: how much the crisis is expanded by the fact that they can be used as a way of, in a sense, cleansing a donor's identity. So due to wanting to at least leave some time for people to ask questions, I'm going to mainly stop there. But I want to raise a whole set of other types of questions and concerns. In both the tax and the corporate context, we always worry about attribution rules, right? How do you become an owner? So we have to know, do we use family attribution rules? Do we use other types of ways of combining ownership interests to know if there's effective control or not, or if there's some type of improper influence? How do we do look-throughs? This is a real problem in I think all of our industries. You know, if you can set up 12 corporations with holding companies, how do you actually get through to find out who the real owner is? We're seeing it in the campaign finance disclosure regime, right, where the disclosure is of the corporation, not of its actual members. And of course, if a corporation gives to another corporation, we make it even further. What does it mean to be foreign? Do we care about where it's organized? Do we care about who its members are? What about we have having corporate inversion now? What about when a standard U.S. corporation leaves and goes to a foreign country? So it's now in a foreign country, not even paying U.S. tax, but it maybe is made up of a majority of U.S. shareholders. Is that a foreign corporation? Or do we want corporations that don't even pay any U.S. tax to be able to participate in our election process? So what I'd say is what tax law really tells us about corporate involvement in campaign advocacy is that the situation is a mess. I mean, I wish I could give you like a really more academic, wonderful world for this, but the fact is tax law is a mess because of the ability to manipulate corporate forms both here and abroad to hide income. And bringing that kind of disaster into the election law context is only going to be a further disaster. So what I really urge is, as much as possible, we need to get our hands on the corporate form. You know, the Supreme Court came in and basically said, you know, corporations have this right, but we all know that corporations aren't people. It's going to take me a long time to have children, raise them up enough so they're voting for the people that I think they should vote for, and then they may not even listen to me, right? But in the corporate context, I can do that with people like this in a matter of minutes. So we really have to get a hold on how these corporate entities work and how we want to have a disclosure regime and a regulatory regime that gives them the rights that they're entitled to have under Citizens United while protecting the liberties that are so important to us. So I thank you for the opportunity to be here today. It's always nice to do something else as a dean, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much. That was incredible, really, all of you. We have a lot of great questions, but I'm going to assert the moderator's privilege and ask the first one myself. This one goes most directly to Professor Jackson, but I'll also invite Professor Coates to weigh in. As with our other panelists, we're looking for ways of moving forward, you know, and possible insights that can be gained from other fields. Now, you said there's no law, but, you know, there may not be law in the corporate context directly on what corporations should politically disclose, but there are rules and laws in the corporate context about what constitutes ownership and control of an entity. So I'll invite you to speak for a few minutes about, and I realize that there may be different standards in different states, but, you know, how is that issue looked at in the corporate context? And, you know, because maybe there's something there that we could use as a starting point to say, well, maybe this is what constitutes foreign, you know, if there's a definition of ownership and control, you know, Dean Tobin raised the fundamental question, what does it mean to be foreign? You know, maybe we could look to that potential avenue to move forward on.
So I'm delighted to have the chance to say more about that. I agree with Dean Tobin that some of the existing standards we have in corporate and securities law might be insightful in this respect. So, as he mentioned, we have a 5% beneficial ownership rule that requires disclosure under the Williams Act. And not only that, but one thing I'll say about that that might be useful for your consideration, yours and the staff's, is that we go even further. We require this 5% threshold. If you own 5% or more of the beneficial securities of a publicly traded company, not only do you have to disclose that you exist, but you have to disclose who you are, where you got the money to buy this stuff, and here's the important part, what your intentions are. Do I intend to try to take control? Do I intend to be a passive investor? We have different forms for this, and there's a lengthy debate in front of the SEC about that. So that's one set of thoughts. Here's one more. There is some data on this, but as Professor Coates explained, it's really rather incomplete and not directed at this question. But if you want to study the issue carefully, large institutional investors in this country who own public companies have to file a form. It's called Form 13F. Yeah, securities law. We just have the most boring names for every possible. Yeah, I mean, I don't even know.
Oh,
why.
We don't know about that at all.
Yeah, I was going to say. I feel like maybe that's just an agency thing. So, so we have this form that the institutional investor have to file, and it's very rich with data on who owns what. Now, the good news is the data have been used in some research, and you can get it easily. The bad news is it's not directed, Commissioner, at this problem, at the problem of finding foreigners who are owners. These are usually investors who have some investment activity here in the United States, but not always. So you could start with examining these data to get a sense of who are the owners. It'd be very incomplete and only a first cut, but that would be a first start at getting a picture of what's going on. And from there, you could take some guidance, some cues from, Dean Tobin has pointed out, the 5% beneficial owner standards that give some more information about not only who these owners are, but what are their intentions having acquired the stake.
So let me flesh out the 5% a little more and then say something else about control, which is a slightly different question. So beneficial ownership, generally speaking, means, as with the telecom structure, either voting power or right to profit or equity ownership. So that's the way it's defined. It captures both ideas. The SEC is slightly more worried about warrants and the like. So warrants don't count, options don't count, converts don't count, except if they're used to influence control. So there's sort of a residual non-bright line standard that could be used to deem it to be ownership. There's one other thing that you might think about, and if you're going to take this kind of general beneficial ownership approach, the reason for it, by the way, is precisely that. If you look simply to the corporate law, the nominal owner of the shares of most, certainly public companies and even many private companies, is not really the owner. It's a conduit set up not to evade or do anything that we might be worried about in this context, but simply for administrative ease. And so the depository trust company that was referred to earlier is a collective, a non-profit membership organization that banks and brokers run. They basically own most stock, if you looked at corporate law question, who owns the stock. But they only own it on behalf of the banks and brokers. And then the banks and brokers, in turn, don't really own it. They own it on behalf of their customers, trusts, clients, brokerage firms, and the like. So the SEC, realizing this many, many years ago, said we can't think about corporate law, because what we're interested in is disclosure of the risk of control shifting. Control isn't limited to formal ownership. It also is through all these intermediate ways. So they came up with a definition of beneficial ownership that goes all the way out to whoever can influence votes or has the right to get profit from the organization. In addition, they realized many, many years ago in the context of some scandals that people could get around that by splintering their ownership up 4.9, 4.9, 4.9, get much higher than 5, effectively control a company. So they have a concept called group. And the term group has purposefully never been defined so as to scare all the lawyers who are giving advice to their clients. It basically means group. it means kind of anything beyond mere communication. So it would certainly pick up, for example, in your area, the head of a campaign who shares offices with the head of a super PAC, and they talk to each other every single day. Almost certainly they would be a group under the SEC's conception of this. That would be easy to capture. Less clear would be truly independent owners who collectively look at the candidate's website and take cues from it and act in a concerted way that happens to be exactly the same kind of independent expenditure result, right? Sending out mailers that look very similar to each other. That would be probably on the border, I think, in the SEC area. All right, so that's on ownership. On control, both within securities law and within the foreign ownership restrictions, going beyond telecom and going to the other industries I've talked about, and under state corporate law for some takeover regulation purposes, you can find thresholds for control at 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, and 50, and probably there's one at 40. I don't remember it off the top of my head. So anything that gets you all the way up, any threshold in there. And I would say if there's a policy rationale for all the different choices, if it's a disclosure regime, then you'd start low because why not? And in fact, I've never actually heard a credible articulation of a real reason not to disclose 5% ownership, with the one exception that sometimes people like Warren Buffett will argue that disclosure of what stocks he's buying gives away his strategy, and he doesn't want to give away competitively sensitive strategy to his competitor investors. So the SEC even has a way of dealing with that, which is you can delay just to the SEC and then to the public on a delayed basis. And at the opposite extreme, if what you're after is a ban, you just simply cannot engage in this kind of activity, that would push you towards a higher threshold of the kind that the Telecom Act, implements. So those are some further thoughts on those two choices.
Thank you. So here's a question that came in by email that kind of touches on something that you just mentioned. And this is for any of the panelists on panel two. I was wondering if they could comment on the impact of H.R. 5053 on foreign money in U.S. elections and non-disclosed money in elections in general. H.R. 5053 is the Preventing IRS Abuse and Protecting Free Speech Act, love the names of these things, which just passed in the House of Representatives and would, in addition to other things, remove the requirement that nonprofit organizations report their donors to the IRS in the Form 990 Schedule B. I'm just reading the questions that came in.
So I'm commenting on something I know a lot about and know very little about, and that I have not read this bill. But I've worked a lot with 990s and know a lot about the reason for disclosure on 990s. I will say it is incredibly important from a tax compliance standpoint that you have a sense of what's on the 990s. Now, what is also very important for people to know is that the 990s donor disclosure is used for IRS tax compliance purposes and is not released to the public at large. It's the provision of the law already doesn't require that to be released. And, you know, it is this, to me, fictional fear of the IRS getting that information that's driving it. But the IRS has to make sure that nonprofit tax-exempt organizations are actually what they say they are. They have tremendous benefits under our existing law. They are exempt from property tax in a lot of cities and states. They have, depending on the type of tax-exempt organization, donations to those organizations are tax-exempt. If they are making profit in their organization and it's related to their tax-exempt activity, then that profit is tax-exempt. There are significant public policy reasons why we want to know the donors to those activities. And under existing law, they are not disclosed to the public. Now, it won't make your questioner happy. I mean, one of the things I've proposed is it should be. Right, that outside of the 501c3 context, when people are engaged in political advocacy, we should be disclosing the donors who give $5,000 or more, and it's not administratively burdensome because we're already collecting it. But the idea that the IRS wouldn't have that information is really a very difficult. It would make their compliance requirements very difficult.
I can't help but, you know, Scalia's comment about having the moral courage to stand by your convictions and be publicly identified with your free speech seems to me to be relevant here. And anybody's idea of free speech being hiding in the shadows. We're not talking about membership in the NAACP where disclosure of your identity might lead you to being lynched. We're talking about Exxon or Chevron hiding behind this as a way of channeling money through a nonprofit to influence elections without anybody even remotely possibly knowing, much less the public, which they can't anyway. It's just ridiculous.
Okay, here's another.
Flat out ridiculous. You want to go live in Russia? Go move to Russia.
Well, Justice Scalia did say that democracy would be doomed if people didn't have that kind of civic courage. Here's a question that perhaps comes from a different perspective. Assuming the state interest in self-government is much stronger than the interest in foreign influence and domestic communications, do you think the FCC's 20% threshold is far too high for election law purposes? And I think that is probably directed at Mace, but anybody who wants to weigh in is welcome to.
I'm not sure that I'd be comfortable saying whether it's appropriate or not for election law purposes. But I think I can get to an answer, or at least help amplify what I think is going on in the question by looking at talking a little bit about the FCC's ownership attribution standards, because as in other industries and other regimes, the FCC deems certain interests that are far below what we would, I think, intuitively think of as controlling interests or perhaps even influential interests as being ownership interests that must be disclosed to them and that could have regulatory consequences. In the corporate context, it's a 5% test, which seems to be pretty common based on what I'm hearing. But think about a limited partnership or an LLC where the commission is taking the position that any interest, irrespective of its economic value, that is to say a 1/100th% partnership interest, will be deemed to be ownership of the entire partnership unless the holder of that interest subscribes to certain insulating criteria that effectively screen her from any participation in her influence over the day-to-day operations or affairs of the partnership. And those are prescribed limitations, the failure to comply with which can cause your interest to be deemed to be an interest in the whole. Think about the consequences that could have for structural ownership restrictions, for foreign ownership restrictions, and the like. The FCC has spent decades grappling with the question of how much influence is too much influence. How do we quantify it? How do we restrict it? And the 5% figure has tended to be a proxy. They know it when, like Justice Stewart, they know it when they see it, that 5% allows you to have a voice in corporate affairs. And I dare say the number could be lower, actually. How many 13, is it D's or G's, actually get filed, disclosing an interest in excess of 5%? I would dare say not many, right? I don't know.
I think actually about 30 to 40% of U.S. public companies do have a 13D filer. Yeah. The very largest ones, it's a much smaller percentage just because it's hard to get that much capital.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd add to that is I think the partnership distinction and LLCs are in many ways more like partnerships than they are like corporations in this respect, not only tax but also here. They're subject to very extensive agreements which govern which create the governance structure for them. And so whereas a standard business corporation, there are certain strong presumptions about how it will be governed. With the partnership, it's not true, and that's why having a very, very low ownership interest often is coupled with rights that effectively give you significant influence through that partnership agreement. I can't imagine any agency wanting to read these agreements and try to sort them on the basis of actual granted powers, which is why I think the presumption you're talking about makes sense. That is to sort of force the person using this structure to show you that they're not conveying control in that way. And the other way to go would just be have a interorum undefined notion of control, which after the fact they could go to jail for if in fact they had it. That would be the other, that's effectively what the SEC does.
We don't send people to jail here.
Find them.
That's another building across the way. Here's another question from email that again, touches on some of the same issues. Can the panel explain an individual's ownership interest in corporate assets? In particular, do shareholders have an indivisible interest in the entirety of a corporation's assets such that a 1% shareholder has a 1% ownership interest in every dollar of the corporation's? If that is the case, can one really say as a matter of law that any dollar of a corporation with any foreign shareholder ownership could be said to be wholly domestic?
So a standard corporation, if you own 1% of the shares, you have a 1% right in the corporation's value. if and when it's liquidated, and 1% of the dividend stream attached to it, and 1% of the voting rights. Now, you might think 1% of the voting rights doesn't sound like very much, but actually you might very well be the largest individual voting holder of a large public company with 1% of the shares. And in the current corporate governance environment, the boards of companies that are confronted by 1% shareholders listen to them. Not, you know, they don't do what they say necessarily all the time, but they do engage with them. So I don't know if that's my stab at that answer.
Yeah, that's right. So when we teach corporate law to law students who are thinking about these issues for the first time, we explain that what a share in a corporation gives you is, as Professor Coates explained, 1% interest in the value of the firm, if you prefer its ongoing profits. But what it doesn't entitle you to do is to call them up and say, hey, look, give me 1% of the money. And this is a very important legal distinction. It's important from the way I think about corporate law, because it frees the corporation to make investments. They don't have to worry that the owners will call them up and say, hey, look, that looks like a great desk. Could you send it to my place? Because I own 1%, and that's about 1% of the stuff in here. That's not the law. But I think I'm not sure how much that tells us about whether the money in the corporation is foreign money, so to speak. And here's why. For me, anyway, what we're more interested in is the subject that you asked me about and that we've been discussing, which is control of the corporate resources. And for the reasons Professor Coates gave, 1% ownership in a public corporation could yield a significant amount of control. The way to think about this, I think, is that the corporation is this box with enormous resources. And the interesting question is not whose money is it, and can we trace back? But the interesting question is who decides what happens with those resources? And the answer, in the case of a 1% shareholder of a very large public company, is that they'll be given a fair amount of attention. And I want to highlight one ironic thing that's worth noting here, which is that in the last decade or so, shareholders of U.S. public corporations, for various reasons, have been given a lot more influence than they once had. And the thing to understand about this, so there's many reasons why that might be good. There are reasons why it might not be good. And one thing to keep in mind is that because that's true, that there's no borders on that change. Right, that's equally true of a shareholder who is a U.S. shareholder in the way you want to speak about, and a foreign shareholder. Now, I think that's just worth understanding from your perspective, because increasingly U.S. corporations are becoming more responsive to shareholder interests, and that's something for you to keep in mind, given that we know corporations are actions in electors in elections.
Okay, so here's another question from the room: are charitable contributions by a public company subject to the business judgment rule?
Mostly yes.
So a question I'm often asked about this idea that they should have to disclose their corporate spending on politics is, should the same be true about their charitable contributions? And this is where it's great to be a professor and not something else, because I'm just required to tell the truth. That's like the one obligation of my job. And the truthful answer is there is no, in my view, intellectually consistent way to think they should disclose their spending on politics and not their spending on charity. They're enormously similar. The managers, my whole argument is about the manager's interest and what they do with shareholders' money. Managers might have interest in giving money to charity for particular reasons. They might conflict with the shareholders' interest, and if that's the reason to require disclosure, that's equally true of charitable contributions as it might be of political contributions. That said, my view is that there are lots of reasons why shareholders might feel much more strongly about information having to do with politics than they would information having to do with charity. Because, for example, if you're a shareholder of a public company, it might trouble you that the money that you've given to the corporation is going to be used for politics to send a message that you abhor. And you might feel more strongly about that than you might feel about what they might do with charitable contributions. And so for this case, I think the case for disclosing political spending is marginally stronger. But I think if you believe the arguments I've given, they're equally powerful in the case of charity as they are in the case of political spending.
That's a good point. I was just whispering. You know, as a dean who likes to raise money,
Most of the time, my donors actually want to be disclosed. And I think, you know, that you have two different kind of ways corporations give. But I think most of the time corporations are giving, they're already disclosing in the charitable context. And maybe when they're not, it raises more of your concerns because why are they not? But in general, and then corporations have different ways of giving. They often are giving through foundations and other sort of charitable organizations they've set up. And then oftentimes when they're giving from the corporate treasury, they actually see more of a business reason to be giving, and they want more of a business connection to the donation. So, you know, I wouldn't be troubled one way or the other, as long as you, with all of these things, make the thresholds high enough. I don't think corporations should have to be disclosing $500 activities. I mean, you want it to be real.
Or if they give money to the University of Maryland Law School.
I'm happy to disclose that.
No, I think you're actually making an extremely important point. Because, you know, one of the things that's interesting, this proposal's been out there for some time. And many, many comments have come from many, many sources, investors, politicians, you name it. They've commented on this. The number of comments from corporations, from corporate boards, who say they don't want to disclose. Like, look, we'd really rather not do this, is zero. Zero. It doesn't strike me that corporations have a hard time, like, saying stuff when they want to. I feel like there are a lot of people on K Street whose full-time job is helping them do that. And it's striking to me that they say this. When I talk to boards of directors, they don't say to me, I really don't want to have to disclose this. In fact, what they say is, boy, I'd love to have disclosure. Because then I'll know what my competitors are doing. I'll be able to scale it appropriately. And there'll be some accountability for where my money goes, which is all to the good for a well-run business. And everybody thinks they work for a well-run business. So it's important to note that there are lots of reasons to oppose this kind of thing. But the idea that there's significant corporate opposition to them, at least as has been disclosed in the public comment file, isn't one of them.
Okay, so here's a question that came in by way of Twitter earlier, actually, on the first panel. But I saved it because I thought you guys actually might know a little bit more about this. Could the Bank Secrecy Act be an effective tool to prevent foreign donors from influencing our elections?
So I can say a little bit about that. I mean, the Bank Secrecy Act and a related apparatus of regulations designed to help prevent money laundering is implemented through the banking system. It doesn't quite capture what I think we're focused on, because most equity ownership isn't caught. Most people don't, in any meaningful sense, sell directly to a bank shares or buy and from. In fact, in the U.S., largely banks are forbidden from directly owning. They may sponsor and oversee trusts that own equity shares, but for the most part, the Bank Secrecy Act and the whole apparatus attached to it is aimed at cash, at flows of cash. It could, some of the surveillance pieces of it, I think, could be adapted. And one thing I'll note is that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York survey that I described earlier, that's done under the auspices of a statute giving the Treasury the right to do it, but then it sort of delegates it to the Fed. It's similar. They reach out to banks, brokers, and large companies. They give a survey out. The companies and the banks, brokers have to respond to it, and there's some check on the provision of information to that. None of that's public currently, and it's only aggregated. So the data is only aggregated.
And here's another question from the room. This one's for Mace. What do you think of the, quote, true sponsorship, quote, provision, especially as a means to force disclosure of a group's funders within TV ads themselves, specifically referring to political/issue ads?
Yeah, you know, there is there are provisions in the Communications Act governing the disclosure of the identity of sponsored material on the air. And, of course, that's of particular sensitivity in the political advertising context. And the FCC has been struggling with how to implement provisions that, you know, require what I would call, you know, a look-through to, you know, the true sponsorship of organizational or PAC-funded ads. I guess if the question is if I'm in favor of it, I mean, I guess I am. you know, there's an interesting jurisdictional overlap between your commission and the FCC in this respect. And an interesting tension, too, in that the FCC, under its own implementing statute, cannot censor candidate speech, right? Which itself has had some interesting ramifications in our age with, in particular, shall we call them abortion-focused spots and spots containing graphic imagery, which broadcasters endeavor not to air, but ultimately are obligated as a statutory matter to air. The disclosure provisions arise in that context. In that context also, and it's a work in progress at the FCC.
Hey, can I ask a follow-up? Like, I'm just curious about that regime. If
you're supposed to be answering the question.
I know. But he should know. I hope he knows. If I set up a company and I dump $1 million into it, and that company dumps $1 million into a single candidate super PAC, and that super PAC buys a television ad, who shows up as the sponsor for the ad under current law? The super PAC.
Yeah, the super PAC.
So if I name my company something mysterious and the super PAC too, I mean, there's basically no real transparency
right.
There.
Yeah.
Okay.
Citizens for a Great America.
Yeah.
Citizens for a Better Tomorrow. Wasn't that Stephen Colbert's PAC? This has been incredibly illuminating and helpful to me personally, and I hope to everybody else in the room and who's listening in on the audio and video feed. So please join me in thanking this great panel for all their insights. And now, the moment that many of you have been eagerly waiting for, it's lunchtime. So there is food directly across the hall. Restrooms are to the right and the left. And let me say, if anybody is curious or concerned about where their taxpayer dollars are being spent, lunch is on me. The only taxpayer who paid for your lunch is this one sitting right here. So I hope you all go and enjoy. There are veggie wraps, there are chicken wraps.
For me, the shame is that.
And we'll be back here at 2 p.m. to start up with our last panel of the day.